I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. Richard North Patterson traded a trial lawyer's court dockets and closing arguments for a writer's solitary toil and uncertain success. He did not, however, leave the worlds of law and disorder behind. In Patterson's latest novel, his 11th, readers get a down and dirty look at one of politics' goriest proceedings this side of an impeachment trial, confirmation hearings for a Supreme Court nominee. In Protect and Defend, the metaphorical body count mounts as secrets, lies, and reputations collide. But here's what the book jacket won't tell you. Patterson's book has been the rage on Capitol Hill, where real-life dramas can make some fiction look uninspired by contrast. Not so with Patterson, whose imagination may prove to be prescient as well as vivid. Connection listeners, what is the line between fact and fiction when law and politics are the central characters? And is it really suspending disbelief? If it's so darn credible? We're making the Richard North Patterson connection this hour, and we want you to join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard North Patterson, thank you for joining me. Let's start by setting up the story behind Protect and Defend. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm just fine and reasonably awake here in Chicago. But the story was meant to combine the political elements you've been talking about for Supreme Court nomination with the two worst, most difficult areas of the abortion war, so parental consent and late-term abortion. So I imagined a new president who wanted to make the first woman a nominee to be Chief Justice and has found the perfect person, a bright and gifted woman who has no record on abortion at all, never talked about it publicly, never written about it, has had no abortion cases. Unfortunately, rocking toward her court after her nomination but before her confirmation is a case in which a 15-year-old girl who was 5 1/2 months pregnant discovers her baby is hydrocephalic, likely but not certain to have no meaningful mental capacity, and if she goes to term, there's a small but measurable chance she'll be infertile and will never have kids again. Her father is a principled pro-life activist, a professor of ethics at a law school. He absolutely opposes abortion as a matter of conscience. There's a law which allows him to do so, absent a contrary ruling by a court. And so her mission is to have the law declared unconstitutional and in time for an abortion. And regrettably for the president, his nominee, it ends up, as I say, heading toward her court at the very moment that her confirmation is on the bubble.
And in fact, the nominee, whose name is Carolyn or Caroline Masters, has a secret herself, right?
Well, indeed. And one of the things that has occurred to me, Nina, in writing this is almost everyone I know, I think anyone knows, has been touched by abortion somewhere or another, whether it's themselves, a wife, a girlfriend, a daughter. In this case, Caroline Masters had a decision a number of years ago, certainly after college, about whether or not to have an abortion. And the way that she resolved that and the fact that she has kept it secret becomes very much part of the weaponry with which the forces opposed her care to defeat her.
Now, you did a lot of research for this book, and you interviewed a lot of people from President Clinton to John McCain. How much time did you spend with President Clinton talking about your various scenarios for how a Supreme Court confirmation could go?
Well, about an hour, and actually it was a great day because I went first to see Bob Dole, and I asked Senator Dole, if you were still majority leader, Senator, and you concluded to take this woman down by any reasonable means at hand, what would you do? And for about an hour or so, he spun me through a very elaborate series of alternatives, including the possibility of a filibuster. Now, I was startled by that because I know that's never happened in the history of a Supreme Court nomination. And yet now, with the Ashcroft nomination and the 42 votes marshaled against him, a real message has been sent to President Bush that if he sends an unacceptable nominee, that weapon may be used against him. So that was very, very interesting. I went to see the president that evening. Again, for about an hour. And he said, you know, if they were really thinking And they were really playing hardball. They do A, B, and C, much of which Senator Dole had mentioned to me. And he said, and then we'd have to do X, Y, and Z. And we ended up spinning this very elaborate public relations and inside baseball strategy for winning over senators vote by vote. And it was quite fascinating. I mean, he's talking to President Clinton about politics. It's like talking to Michael Jordan about basketball. I mean, you can't help but learn a lot.
You know, I couldn't help but wonder when I realized that you'd interviewed President Clinton about this. He, of course, had two Supreme Court nominations, neither of which posed much of a problem for him. But then he took the route of basically accepting the recommendations of the Republican on the Judiciary Committee, Orrin Hatch, and his two favorite Democrats were liberal Democrats by his lights were Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. And in the end, President Clinton picked those two people and he didn't have a fight. did he talk to you at all about that?
Well, I asked him, I said, Mr. President, if you had this woman who was in trouble on an issue as incendiary as late-term abortion or, quote, partial birth abortion, as his opponents call her, would you expend the political capital on her? And he said yes, because it would be the right thing to do. Now, he was never tested by Breyer and Ginsburg because they weren't tough nominations. But my president here is a pretty tough-minded guy, and one of the things that he decides is he would rather have this nominee go down and have the forces of the right come out against her in all their venom than back off. It's his first nomination. The Chief Justice has indeed died directly after his inauguration, and he's going to lay down a marker about who is going to be in charge of these nominations and who is going to be an effective president.
You also interviewed Senator John McCain, who is in is the model very clearly for the sort of the hero of this book, who in the book, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is a McCain-esque figure, a war hero with whose main issue is campaign reform. I mean, it's a fairly unmistakable parallel, although the family parallels aren't the same. And I'm wondering what your discussions with Senator McCain were about this.
Well, we had pretty limited discussions about this book. John is a good friend, and he helped me immensely with the prequel to this book. If I wanted to make this character precisely John McCain, Nina, I could have done a much more particular job because I know him quite well. But what I did want to capture Republicans relatively independent, which is a tough place to be in that party these days. Being an ideological deviant is no fun, obviously. But also to capture something that's very interesting about Senator McCain and some other people who have gone through hardships. If you look at Lincoln, who fought depression, the first Roosevelt, who was sickly kid and his wife died when he was very young, his first wife, the second Roosevelt with polio, Bobby Kennedy, the loss of a brother, Nelson Mandela, remarkably, all of that imprisonment, and of course John McCain as a prisoner of war, and my fictional Chad Palmer with much the same experience. You have to ask the question, what does hardship do to perhaps mold leaders for the better? In what perspective did, for example, Senator McCain's experience as a prisoner of war give him on politics? I think one thing it taught him is there are worse things in the world than losing an election and making people mad. It's made him a remarkably interesting and, I think, effective figure on Capitol Hill.
On the abortion side, and there's a lot of information in the book, and since I've covered this debate a lot, I know that the information that you put out is far as I know, accurate. And the whole question of so-called late-term abortions is much misunderstood, and there's a lot of myth on both sides of the argument about it. And I know you went to great lengths to talk to everybody involved, but the Right to Lifers would not talk to you. Did they tell you why?
Well, no, they didn't, but I have a theory about it. They've been very successful in propagating the belief widely that late-term abortions, and for the purpose of the discussion, we'll say after 23 weeks, are common. They're elective. They're performed on the healthy mothers of healthy fetuses by callous doctors and supported by a pro-choice movement who is so indifferent to even the worst kind of butchery that this kind of procedure doesn't offend them. If that were true, that's what I would have written, but in fact, it is not. I think it is pretty much beyond dispute that there are roughly 1 in 1,500 of abortions every year. They stem from the worst kind of fetal anomalies, like the absence of a brain or another essential organ, or rarer yet, in situations where an abortion is necessary for a woman's emergency medical treatment for cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and the like. There are very, very few brave and principled doctors who perform these. They're very difficult and very dangerous, as the death of Dr. Slepian in Buffalo, the murder of Dr. Slepian, would suggest. So that almost everything that most people believe about, quote, partial birth abortion isn't true. And I think one reason that the pro-life folks, who I very much wanted to talk to, and I think it would have been a better book if I had, avoided me, is that the symbolism of this thing is wonderful and the images are horrific and very effective for them politically, but the facts just aren't there. And I've never had anyone on that other side, in a public forum or otherwise, marshal any persuasive evidence that the facts are any different than
you,
I know them.
But you have a view on this, and you've always had a view, and you've appeared at a number of Planned Parenthood events, et cetera. I mean, so they might perhaps be suspicious of you too, fairly.
Well, you know, fair enough, and I certainly don't have the constitutional right to demand that people talk to me. But I think that I have tried to fairly present facts as facts. And I came into this, Nina, with a lot less knowledge, obviously, than I left with. And I would have liked to have had those discussions. But as I say, if you ask the question, why didn't they meet with me, perhaps it was that they felt that they could see a secular humanist coming. But perhaps also I was exploring subjects in which they just didn't have answers to support their rhetoric.
Did you talk to any judges?
Oh, I did. I talked to a number of federal judges at the appellate and trial level. One of the fun things I did in this book, and I've never seen it done in fiction, perhaps it has been, is try to present the decision-making process in a complicated case, not only from the standpoint of the lawyers in the trial, but the judges in a very sharply divided appellate court. And in this case, the tyranny case, my abortion case, goes en banc, which is to say it's heard by the entire or half of the Ninth Circuit, which is, roughly 11 judges. And so you have a portrayal of a very ideologically divided court at odds with each other in a case where one of its members' careers as a Supreme Court nominee may rise or fall on the way that they resolve the case. And that was fascinating to do.
And did you think that that might really happen?
Well, not only do I know that kind of thing happens, but I would have loved him in a fly on the wall for the discussions of Bush versus Gore, because the process I imagined, a very fractured, ideologically divided, and ultimately angry court,
I'm
going
to have to interrupt you
saw.
For a second because we need to go to a break. You're listening to The Connection and author Richard North Patterson, author of Protect and Defend. The number here is 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is
I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. My guest this hour is Richard North Patterson, author of Protect and Defend. It's a tall order to render the fictional worlds of law and politics as surprising as they are in reality. Richard North Patterson, at any point in writing Protect and Defend, did you look at the headlines afterwards and say, by God, it seems to be coming true?
It was very weird because I turned the book in May of 2000, and more and more things seem to be coming true about the book. And really, the Ashcroft nomination, in a way, was both a reflection of the politics I talked about in my book, and I think a prelude for what I showed in the book. I think that the next Supreme Court nomination is going to be, in all likelihood, my book precisely, a holy war over abortion, because Roe versus Wade is really very much in play here. With the change of one, certainly two votes in the Supreme Court, we could have a repeal of Roe versus Wade. And I think those folks who have looked upon that case as a permanent protection of abortion are deluding themselves.
The number here to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK if you have a question for author Richard North Patterson. You know, Mr. Patterson, one of the reasons I like the book, better, frankly, than other books of yours that I have read, is that it had a real verisimilitude. There was a moment in, for example, in one of the chapters where you sort of state a rule that is well known to every reporter that's ever covered a confirmation hearing, and that is, if the senator asking the question is talking much more than the nominee is doing very well. That means the senator is sort of doesn't feel that he or she has anything really to go with and is just speechifying. And but as we look forward to the likelihood of a Supreme Court nomination battle, either this summer or possibly next year, and even possibly, I would think, if it happens this year, it would likely be for the position of Chief Justice. You know, the whole question of abortion is so-called decided, just as capital punishment is decided. That's what liberals always say when they go to the Senate. They say, confirm me. I won't screw you up on capital punishment. I won't say it's unconstitutional because it is decided. What happens when a conservative nominee comes before the Senate and says Roe versus Wade is decided?
Well, I think that there will be a certain inclination not to credit that very much. Remember when Clarence Thomas came and said that he had never really talked about abortion in his life or really thought about it much, not just publicly but privately. That made him the only person in America, perhaps, who could make that claim. And I think with Roe now on the razor's edge, it's unlikely that that's going to be accepted. I think it's going to be pushed very hard. There's going to be a lot of questions about the right to privacy, which, of course, is one of the predicates for the right of abortion in Roe versus Wade. And I think there's going to be some very tough questioning. My guess, Nina, is we're going to get something like a very good-looking Hispanic nominee. And President Bush and the Republicans will say basically only in America, and then we dare you to the opponents to see whether they can't get a nominee through with a wave of understandable emotion and pride that we've elevated another minority to the court.
We're going to be calling in a moment Professor Lawrence Tribe from Harvard, who actually was at a Democratic Senate retreat about a week or two ago, talking about what the Democrats should do when a Supreme Court nomination comes up. And we've got him on the line right now. Professor Tribe, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Nina. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Where are the Democrats on this? You were at their retreat. What are they talking about? I mean, I would bet the farm that there is going to be a Hispanic nominee, and that Mr. Patterson is absolutely right. And what did you tell them about what you think their obligations are?
Well, I do think that Mr. Patterson is probably right, and his book sounds like a good read. I'm putting it on my list for this summer. Basically, I talked to the senators who were there. There were about 40 or 42 of them, about the historic role of the Senate, and wanted to make sure that they were all up to speed on the fact that traditionally, the Senate is not a rubber stamp. It's not a potted plant. It, from time to time, has played a very active role in rejecting nominees, even if they were smart and good-looking and met various diversity requirements, geographically at least, and even if they had enormous integrity, when the basic philosophy that they seemed to represent struck senators as dangerous to the Constitution. And what I emphasized is the importance of individual senators not getting spooked by the claim that if you inquire of a nominee about what he or she thinks about various rights of privacy and how those rights should be defined, not to be spooked by the claim that you're somehow interfering with judicial independence. Because the fact is that the one point at which the nation politically can have an input into the shape of its own constitutional future with people who are going to serve for life and people who, as we now know, can even pick a president, the one point they have that opportunity, and the only point, really, because impeachment isn't realistic in this context, is at the confirmation hearing. And so I talked with the senators about how probing the questions ought to be and how it's possible to ask some probing questions without imposing a litmus test or going through the foolish ritual of asking how a senator thinks a particular nominee would vote in a very specific case.
You know, I'd like to jump in and say I think Professor Tribe's analysis is absolutely right. One of the things that happened in the wake of the Bork nomination is the idea got about is it was somehow unrespectable to probe a nominee's ideology and beliefs and to reject them because they were outside the mainstream. So instead we had this focus on personal peccadilloes, whether it was sex or something else. And I think we have to return to the notion that we ought to have a decent regard for privacy and people's private lives, but ought to look very hard at the question of public character and public beliefs and whether beliefs are so essentially inhumane or contrary to the spirit of the Constitution, we can reject a nominee quite properly on those grounds.
Right, and we've done it from the very beginning. I mean, interesting, when I made a study of this back in the mid-80s, I was kind of shocked to discover, it shows how little history I knew when I started, that probably the greatest Chief Justice, John Marshall, wouldn't have been on the court if the Senate hadn't rejected George Washington's earlier nomination of John Rutledge on essentially ideological grounds.
You're listening to The Connection. The number here is 1-800-423-8255, and we're going to go to a caller. Professor Tribe, stay with us.
Sure.
The caller is Mark from Cranston, Rhode Island. Mark, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Nina. It's a great show, Nina.
What's your question?
I have two questions for Mr. Patterson and the other caller. One is, I just read Wrath of Angels, which is the chronicling of the violent reaction by anti-abortion groups. And does he think this violence will continue, since many people who are supporters of Timothy McVeigh say Timothy McVeigh was just preface? And the second question, Nina, is if we could we change the name of pro-choice to pro-life of the mother?
Well,
those two questions. I'm going to hang up and let you guys talk about it.
It's a little loaded.
Well,
let me just say something here before you answer that. You know, there's a big debate in newsrooms. At National Public Radio, our official style is we call people either anti-abortion or either anti-abortion activists or abortion rights activists. And I've always asserted that you should call people what they want to be called and what everybody understands them to be. That's pro-life and pro-choice. But let me go to Mr. Patterson and let him answer the question.
Well, I agree with that, actually. I mean, I try to speak to people in terms of the rhetoric with which we become familiar, and I don't think there's any point in getting into real sort of twistings of words where you're anti-choice or pro-this and you attempt to demonize the other side. So I do pro-life and pro-choice as a matter of course. As in terms of your question of violence, it is a scary part of the American landscape, and I'm really not sure that we are going to be secure about women's clinics and protecting people involved in reproductive rights anytime soon. For one thing, the rhetoric is so extreme. If you start by assuming that a fetus is a life from the moment of conception, which is a perfectly valid moral point of view, that's one thing. But then you get very quickly into, and therefore abortion is a holocaust, and abortion providers are murderers, and like killing Hitler, the only fair thing to do is to do away with abortion providers. And very quickly we get into this sort of fever swamp where one's beliefs justify murder. I don't characterize most of the pro-life movement that way at all. Responsible pro-life leaders obviously are appalled by those tactics, but that rhetoric is out there. It's around. There are enough people, and frankly, with enough guns in this country, which is a whole other problem, to make being an abortion provider a risky business, regrettably. And as a result, we have 86% of American counties, for example, without a known abortion provider.
Let me ask the two of you a devil's advocate question here for a minute, though. You both are firm advocates of the right to choose, the right to have, woman's right to have an abortion. But the president of the United States has been elected with the country knowing full well that he has great reservations about that, and certainly knowing that he advocates a parental consent law and all kinds of other things. Why should he not have his choice for president? And I'd like to remind you that in the days when it was civil rights advocates who were being named to the court by civil rights presidents, liberals very much didn't think it was right to ask people's judicial philosophies to the point where it might so-called compromise their judicial independence. That was the line they took.
A couple of points, Nina. First of all, I do think that issues of fundamental human rights, whether the civil rights of minorities, or if you believe the fetus is a human being, the rights of the fetus, or if you believe that women really should be able to control their destiny, the rights of women. Those things are not really up for resolution in our kind of constitutional democracy by majority vote. And they are really to be decided in the ultimate process of constitutional adjudication. That said, a president who has a strong belief that we ought to reverse Roe v. Wade is entirely within his rights, trying to achieve that end. I wish he'd be a little more honest about it sometimes, trying to achieve that end by trying to put people on the court who have that point of view and knowing that that's what he's likely to be trying to do. Members of the Senate who think that that would be a constitutional disaster are within their rights trying to stop it. That is, it's not a question of whether there's something kind of improper about trying to push the president's own constitutional philosophy under the court. As you point out, Lyndon Johnson certainly tried to do that with Thurgood Marshall in 1967. And at that point, the far right had no hesitation about asking him questions designed to make Southern senators nervous and upset. But putting it in balance, you ought to realize that 1967 was the last time, and that's quite a while ago, the last time that any president of the United States has self-consciously appointed someone who was clearly a liberal as opposed to a conservative or a moderate. And I think that is because the presidents on the right have been willing to pay quite a political price for their judicial principles. Even seeing nominees like Bork defeated, they came back and put very conservative justices there, whereas more liberal presidents seem to have had a kind of eclectic agenda, not willing to pay a price in terms of health care or anything else for a controversial nominee. And that's created quite a tilt, which is why we have had, on the whole, much more conservative than liberal courts in this country.
And the number here is 1-800-423-8255, and we have Richard on the line calling from Buffalo, New York.
Yes, good morning, Nina. It's great listening to your show.
Good morning.
My view is that I'm very pro-life, but my view is that many of my pro-life colleagues and many of my pro-choice fellow citizens both have it wrong. What Roe versus Wade does is assault constitutional protections. In one of the sections, I think it was Section 7 of Justice Blackmun's dreadful opinion, he said that if the fetus is a person, it enjoys protection, constitutional protections, and cannot be harmed. And then he goes on to make this remarkable statement: we need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. The logic there implies the following, that in cases of questions of doubt, one can destroy the fetus regardless of whether it's human or not. This assaults constitutional protections, the Equal Protection Clause and Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, over which, by the way, we fought a civil war. I do not want to see a civil war, but I do want to see these protections preserved. And I think this is an insidious assault on equal protection, and I think for that reason, even though I'm a liberal Democrat, I oppose the death penalty. I voted for George Bush. Another reason was that George Bush told the truth, whereas Al Gore couldn't.
Mr. Patterson, do you have you heard from a lot of pro-life folks like Richard, who's making this a very articulate argument?
Well, you know, I have, and it's an argument for which I have a great deal of respect. But Richard assumes that it is a matter of constitutional law that a fetus is a life from the moment of conception, and therefore all else follows. If you accept that premise, he's right. It is a premise which is widely debated among all sorts of folks with various religious beliefs or not. And the fact is that it's the right to choose stems from the right to privacy. In Griswold versus Connecticut, for example, Connecticut law which banned the dispensation of birth control devices, kind of remarkable to think about now, in the 1960s was struck down. Similarly, the constitutional belief has been that a woman should not be treated as a loser in God's or nature's lottery just because she becomes pregnant by some mischance, and that given the myriad of different circumstances which attend a woman's pregnancies, from possible medical disasters to inability to support children to rape, incest, to birth control mistakes, that the right to privacy predominates over the particular religious belief that a fetus is sacred. I believe that's a correct interpretation of law, but of course it will always be debated. On the point that Professor Tribe was making about certain laws not being up for a plebiscite or certain rights, I think that's true. But we also have to note that a healthy majority of Americans are in favor of the basic right to choose, and also that a number of Americans who voted for President Bush, who happens to be a personal friend of mine and our family, voted for him not because they were endorsing the pro-life position, but because they found a number of other of his positions attractive, taxes or whatever. So whereas the president has a perfect right to nominate who he chooses, I don't think one can assume either constitutionally or as a matter of the will of the people at this point in time that the pro-life position is one favored, because it isn't.
The phone number is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Our guest is Richard North Patterson, author of Protect and Defend. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is Double.
I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. American politics is blood sport. That's the focus of Richard North Patterson's latest book, Protect and Defend. And we have also with us Professor Lawrence Tribe from Harvard. He's a constitutional scholar, has been advising Democratic senators about how to approach a possible Supreme Court nomination fight. Should it occur? Should there be a vacancy? Should there be a nomination? Which is, of course, the subject of the Patterson book. And Mr. Patterson, you know, I'm wondering about the various artifices that you use. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but that you use in the book to try to bridge the gap between fact and fiction. Now, in the book, you have some particularly disgusting enemies, but they are not, in fact, the pro-life people. The father of this girl, who is steadfastly pro-life and is a very distinguished conservative constitutional law professor, is portrayed in a very sympathetic light, as is her mother. But the organized groups are not. And I wondered if that was to make the book as a vehicle to have good and bad in the book, or whether that is your genuine feeling.
Well,
I mean, is this truth or fiction?
Well, I think it is truth, perhaps somewhat intensified truth, if I might say, which those of us who make stuff up for a living have the privilege of doing. But I did want to make a rather serious point. I think abortion as a moral proposition is infinitely debatable, and I think that the pro-life people are sincere in their beliefs, and that there is a certain nobility toward their feeling about the fetus, however much I might ultimately disagree. So, as a moral proposition, I think it is a significant debate. As a political proposition, however, it has been distorted and abused by, I think, particularly the pro-life forces, and the partial birth abortion myth is a perfect example, in order to serve as a form of political red meat and a fundraising vehicle. And so my portrayal of those characters in very different lights was meant to portray the difference between the moral argument over abortion and the political exploitation of it, and was quite conscious.
But if it is a political and moral debate, then why not have it decided by the political branches of government, both at the state and federal levels, and not the court?
Well, I'm with Professor Tribe there. I think that there are certain rights. For example, the right of black children is found in Roe versus Wade to have equal access to schooling, which are not up for grabs.
You mean Brown versus the board?
Brown versus the Board of Education, yes, which are not up for grabs. If, for example, you toss this back to the state legislature, what you would have is a significant number of girls and women denied access to abortion by state legislatures, which would result in more pregnancies of unwanted children, more teen pregnancies, which is disastrous social policy, and frankly, more deaths, the kind of coat hanger medicine we had before Roe versus Wade.
I think the coat hanger point should be emphasized strongly. The fact is that moderates like Justice Powell had rather pragmatic reasons for being in favor of a woman's right to choose. It was not because they had less respect for the life of the helpless unborn than others. It's because for them the specter of a dead fetus and a dead mother was not respectful of life either. And I suppose it can also be said, even if that danger were not present, it could also be said that believing that the fetus is a person, which not one member of the current Supreme Court does, not Justice Scalia, not Rehnquist, believing that the fetus is a person doesn't really answer the moral quandary anyway, because we don't, in our society, make people serve as involuntary nurturers and incubators for other persons. That's what restrictions on abortion arguably do to women.
The number is 1-800-423-8255, and we have on the line now Pozon. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's your question?
My question is, if we consider abortion to be a fundamental issue where one can believe that it's okay to have an abortion and the other can believe that there is a definite person there that we need to protect, and if those two opinions are fundamental, I question your guess. Why is the term constitutional crisis being used for one over the other if they are fair play?
Well, I think because the stakes are so incredible. We're talking on the one hand about people's definition of what life is, on the other hand about a woman's life and future. The business, as Professor Tribe said, of basically ordering women to have children simply because they happen to be the folks who get pregnant. And I think that there are constitutional issues which stem from that really quite starkly and quite directly. I think it would be a fine thing if pro-life and pro-choice forces engage in argument about whether abortion is appropriate, but directed to the individual woman who made the decision, rather than trying to make a one-size-fits-all law, which basically orders women to have children.
Professor Tribe, you get one last shot at this, and then I'm going to let you go.
Okay. Well, I guess what I want to say is I think that this debate that we're now having is exactly the sort of debate that we're likely to have in one way or another, whether on abortion or on another equally divisive issue, the next time a nominee is put before the Senate, unless it's one of these stealth nominees carefully selected so that there's no paper trail, no record, and then I think we have to face as a country is the question of whether we're willing to play a kind of a Russian roulette with the Constitution and put someone on who's managed to avoid opening his or her mouth, and then just hope that their fundamental philosophy about the Constitution will not jeopardize our rights. I don't think we should be willing to take that gamble, which is why I think that confirmation battles are really here to stay.
Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard Law School, thank you very much for joining us. The number is 1-800-423-8255, and my guest is Richard North Patterson, author of Protect and Defend. And my notion, Mr. Patterson, initially was that we would talk about a book about which is about the confirmation process. And I have learned from this that it's very difficult to do that when the subject is abortion, that all of our calls are about abortion, not about the subject of really about of Supreme Court confirmation or how to bridge the gap between fiction and reality when you're writing a political and legal thriller. And I'm wondering, when you're out on the road promoting the book, whether you have the same experience, or maybe all your fans who come.
No, I picked it. No, not entirely. I picked this issue because it is important and emotional and is revealing of the political process as it is. But there are a number of other points I wanted to make. For example, the difference between public character and private character and what we should be focusing on. I mean, since Watergate and Vietnam and Gary Hart and so on, we've had virtually no corner of a person's life if they enter public office which isn't open to scrutiny. And I wonder whether we aren't driving good men and women from public life on the basis of merely being human. The last campaign, I thought, sort of began to sound like character was no oral sex in the Oval Office. Well, I mean, that's fine, and I'm all for that. But I also question, frankly, John Ashcroft being portrayed as a man of character. Certainly he's a man of rectitude. I gather he doesn't even dance in private. But he did unfairly, in my view, trash symbolic victims like Ronnie White, the African-American justice from Missouri, who was up for a nomination and denied it because of John Ashcroft. And Jim Hormel happens to be a personal friend of mine, ambassador to Luxembourg, perfectly acceptable to Luxembourg, by the way, who Ashcroft deposed because Jim is gay and said, well, you know, we can't send a gay man to a Roman Catholic country that will offend them. Well, that's cynical. And it is political. And so I question whether Mr. Ashcroft's public character wasn't up for scrutiny. And that's another point I'm trying to make. What are we doing to these folks in public life? And shouldn't we care more about how they conduct themselves as a public policy matter and in the political arena rather than every last nook and cranny of their private lives?
The number again is 1-800-423-8255. You know, the other devil in your book is sort of the lobbying class, portrayed by a single individual who, I confess, because it's been at least 6 months since I've read the book, I forget his name, but he's nowhere near as bad as the political opponents, because he's the guy who has the money and sicks on the investigators and even manipulates, in this case, the Republicans who are opposing the nomination. And I'm wondering, again, whether this was an artifice to make a political point that you wanted to make.
Well, quite intentional. And I think, again, the question of money in politics can hardly be exaggerated in fiction or in fact in terms of its importance. There isn't a serious public policy debate in this country, from guns to choice to health care to patients' bill of rights, that isn't affected by the power of money, huge amounts of money. John McCain's bill and Russ Feingold's bill is directed at keeping soft money out of the process. And there isn't any question in my mind that the process by which someone can give $500,000 to a party is a little bit a political party. It's a little more than an elegant form of bribery. And the notion that they're merely buying access, and this is merely a First Amendment issue, is one of the most cynical, the most hypocritical protestations I can imagine. So, yes, I was very much trying to make that point.
I think we have time for one more caller. Russ is calling from Vermont.
Yes, I remember reading a book many years ago by William Sloan Coffin, and in it he makes the point, or takes the position, I don't think I'm distorting it, that abortion is an absolutely terrible, horrible thing, and yet that it should be kept legal. And so my question for your guest is, how does he think that a politician might fare today if they took the took that point of view that abortion is horrible? Let's use our moral suasion to convince people to be careful in their sexual.
But Russ, isn't that what every so-called pro-choice politician says? I'm personally opposed to abortion, but.
Well, it's a good question. I'm actually for abortion, but I also think it's not a very good thing, and that people should be as responsible as possible. And so I don't know whether or not so-called pro-life politicians say that exactly.
They don't, but yeah. But even politicians like Vice President Gore, for example, would say, I'm personally opposed to abortion. I wouldn't want my daughter to have one, but I think a woman ought to have the right to choose.
I see what you're saying. In other words, I'm pro-life and I'm for abortion.
Well, the effort there, I think, is to pick up as many of everybody as you possibly can.
Well, maybe it's the correct way to go, in the sense that if you're not for, I mean, I'm not saying that I'm not for abortion. I'm just saying that it's really not a great thing.
Well,
nobody loves
abortion.
Yeah, nobody loves it, but there are an awful lot of them performed, fewer than there used to be, I might add. Maybe in part because of the effort of anti-abortion advocates, and maybe because they're less and less available, particularly in rural areas. Mr. Patterson, if you had to say one thing about this book, other than about its pro-choice message, which I think is a fair characterization of it, what would you say about it?
I'd say that it is Advise and Consent, the classic political novel, updated, at least my best effort to do so, to take politics from a relatively benign place it was in the 50s with a non-intrusive media and a fairer and more collegial environment, and place dramatic issues in a confirmation battle in the much more Darwinian, really shoot-to-kill political atmosphere we have today. I think, and I hope, it reveals in a dramatic, entertaining, but also quite realistic way the world of Washington politics today and how it might function in an incendiary battle over Supreme Court.
And very quickly, what's your next book about?
Guns, money, and political power. Why it is that we kill each other at such a record rate with the number of weapons we have and what that says about our society.
Thanks so much, Mr. Patterson. I appreciate your being here. And thanks to Lawrence Tribe, who's the Tyler Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard. We had help today from Glenn Alexander, Kim Bichari, Sean Carberry, Darren Mnuchin, Doug Sugertz. We also had help from Theo Mondel. The Connection is produced by Sarah Feel, Kelly Jones, Michael Cavanaugh, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Ben Walker, with intern Tom Gilmore. Our senior producer is Bram Smith. To continue the Richard North Patterson Connection, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. I'm Nina Totenberg, and this is The Connection.
This is WBUR. We're